in the news this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote.
I'm Laurel Bowman. Russian President Vladimir Putin visits Tehran on Tuesday for talks with Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. It's a rare trip outside the former Soviet Union for Putin since Moscow's February 24th invasion of Ukraine. In Tehran, Putin also holds his first face-to-face meeting since the invasion with a NATO leader, Turkey's Tayyip Erdogan, to discuss a deal aimed at allowing the resumption of Ukraine's Black Sea grain exports. The parties will also discuss the war in Syria. Ukraine's parliament dismissed the domestic security chief and prosecutor general on Tuesday, 2 days after President Volodymyr Zelensky suspended them for failing to root out Russian spies. Meanwhile, Russian forces kept up their bombardment of cities across Ukraine with intense shelling of Sumy in the north, cluster bombs targeting Mykolaiv, and a missile strike in Odessa in the south, authorities said Tuesday. After failing to capture the capital, Kyiv, at the outset of the invasion on February 24th, Russia has shifted to a campaign of devastating bombardments to cement and extend its control of Ukraine's south and east. Firefighters in southwestern France battled on Tuesday to contain massive forest wildfires, and Britain recorded its highest ever temperature as a heat wave rising from the south settled over western Europe. Southern and western Germany and Belgium were also braced for potentially record-breaking temperatures in the coming days as the heat wave, which some scientists attribute to climate change, edged north and east. And in the U.S., testimony has begun in the penalty phase of the trial of the young gunman who massacred 17 people at a Parkland, Florida high school back in 2018. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden on Tuesday opened the way for sanctions against governments that unjustly imprison Americans and ordered more detailed travel warnings after a series of high-profile detentions. Biden signed an executive order billed as expanding the set of tools for the U.S. government in what Secretary of State Antony Blinken said was a relentless effort to free citizens overseas. The move comes after wide media coverage of the detention in Russia on drug charges of basketball star Brittany Griner, whose wife initially said Biden was not doing enough. The executive order authorizes government agencies to impose financial sanctions or travel bans on foreign officials or non-state actors involved in unjust detentions of Americans. The State Department, in its travel advisories for Americans, will also begin to highlight in which nations there is an elevated risk of unjust detention. The initial group of nations that will bear a D mark for detention risk will be China, Iran, Myanmar, North Korea, Russia, and Venezuela, an official said. Sri Lanka's main opposition leader withdrew from the presidential race on Tuesday and promised support to a low-profile politician from the ruling party who will take on acting President Ranil Wickremesinghe in a tight contest. The 225-seat parliament votes on Wednesday to choose the new president, who will lead efforts to address the country's economic and political collapse. Bodyguards could have saved Shinzo Abe if they shielded him or removed him from the line of fire in the 2.5 seconds between a missed first shot and a second round of gunfire that fatally wounded him. That's according to security experts who reviewed footage of the former Japanese leader's assassination. The failure to protect Abe from the second shot followed what appeared to be a series of security lapses in the lead-up to the assassination of Japan's longest-serving prime minister on July 8th. That's according to the Japanese and international security experts that I referenced. U.S. average retail gasoline price fell to $4.495 a gallon on Tuesday, slipping below $4.50 for the first time in 9 weeks. Data from the American Automobile Association showed. And the Indian rupee fell to more than 80 per U.S. dollar for the first time on record Tuesday as the greenback extended its rally and foreign capital outflows intensified. For more stories, visit us online at voanews.com. Reporting via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
Thank you. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhibe in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
45% of the national budget is going towards debt servicing, which of course starves other areas of economic endeavor from being funded by government resources.
That was Zambian economist Yusuf Dudia on how the government's foreign debt burden is destroying the nation's economy. Details coming up. Also, a Moroccan court today sentenced 33 migrants to 11 months in jail for illegal entry. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ghana's health service says more than a third of the people quarantined after an outbreak of the Marburg virus, a relative of Ebola, have been cleared to leave isolation. Authorities quarantined 98 people this week following two deadly cases of the virus in Ghana. Kent Mensah reports from Ghana's capital, Accra.
It is the first time ever the disease has been confirmed in the West African country, although nearby Guinea recorded a single case last year. The Director General of the Ghana Health Service, GHS, Dr. Patrick Kuma Abuaji, told VOA that 39 out of the 98 contacts have completed their quarantine. He said there is no cause for alarm.
We've had 98 contacts, health workers, mortuary workers, family members, about 39 of them completed their quarantine. Three of the 98 contacts, we have randomly tested 13 of them and they've all been negative so far. There's nothing to worry except to know what to look out for, what to avoid.
Kuma Abuaji said Ghana's surveillance mechanism has been on red alert to catch suspected cases of Marburg.
Well, we have general surveillance for all conditions and all, including this, and that's why the system was able to pick it up early. If we didn't pick it early, it would have spread to other people. Then it became difficult to contain it. We have a response team in the regions and the districts who are responsible for all these things. And then also visit the community, community volunteers who have been trained to identify any strange disease and report it for immediate response.
The World Health Organization says fatality rate for past Marburg outbreaks have ranged from 24% to 88%, and there are no vaccines or antiviral treatments. The WHO, in a statement to VOA, commended local health officials for being proactive in detecting the disease and said it is mobilizing resources to help Ghana control the virus. Health authorities have responded swiftly, getting a head start preparing for a possible outbreak. The country representative of the WHO, Dr. Francis Kasolo, said. He added, this is good because without immediate and decisive action, Marburg can easily get out of hand. Anita Samoa, an independent public health advocate, says more must be done to educate the public about the symptoms of Marburg and safety measures.
Individual advocates and health awareness creators are very important. They should be engaged so that more awareness is created. The awareness should be more there. So there would be a vaccine. It is the precautionary method that should be followed strictly. Reporting any suspected case or individual you feel has the symptoms, the fever, the bleeding, coughing blood and urine containing blood.
Apart from Guinea and Ghana, Marburg has also appeared in Angola, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Kenya, South Africa, and Uganda. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
South African authorities investigating the mysterious deaths of 21 youths last month at a bar in the Eastern Cape have detected methanol, a toxic industrial alcohol, in the systems of the diseased. Medical experts have yet to conclude if the amount of methanol was lethal, but say initial reports rule out poisoning from carbon monoxide or ethanol, the alcohol found in drinks. Vicky Stark has more from Cape Town, South Africa.
Due to a backlog at the toxicology lab in Cape Town, officials are not able to say when the final report will be available. Some of the 21 teenagers, the youngest being just 13 years old, were out celebrating the end of mid-year exams. 17 of them died on the scene, while the other four died later in hospitals. Dr. Lita Matewane, the Deputy Director General of the Eastern Cape Health Department, says the division has received the initial results from blood work.
We are looking for other activities that might come through. For example, formic acid, which is a byproduct of methanol and may actually tell us more about the concentrations and the levels that actually are found and whether there is toxicity.
Matewane says investigators are also testing gastric samples.
That will also tell us what they've been drinking and so forth. So there are other activities and other toxicological processes that are going on in the lab in Cape Town.
Speaking of the backlog of cases at the lab, the Premier of the Eastern Cape Province, Oscar Mabuyane, says he understands that the families of the deceased young people want answers, but he has appealed for patience and understanding.
Because all cases are sensitive. All people are looking for the results of their cases, whether it's gender-based violence or rapes and other things that are really taking place out there.
Meanwhile, National Police Minister Becky Cele was also at Tuesday's media briefing. He says police have not ruled out the possibility of more arrests. The bar owner and two employees have been charged in connection with contravening the Liquor Act with regards to selling alcohol to minors. The 52-year-old owner will appear in court on August 19. The two employees were fined just 2,000 rand or $117 each, prompting outrage on social media. Cele again reassured the community that all is being done to get to the bottom of what happened.
The police are here. The special investigation team from both provincial and the head office, since we take the matter very, very serious and hope that you will find out as the case continues what really happened on that particular day. We're not ruling out any form of finding other people that will be able to answer and give accountability of what happened.
Officials say they will be doing more to help the families, some of whom have lost their only child. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
A Moroccan court today sentenced 33 migrants to 11 months in jail for illegal entry into the Spanish enclave of Milala last month. The French news agency quoted the lawyer for the migrants, Khalid Amzeh, as calling it a very heavy sentence. At least 23 migrants died after around 2,000 people, many from Sudan, stormed the frontier on June 24th, the worst death toll in years of attempted migrant crossing into Spain's Ceuta and Melilla enclaves, which represent the EU's only land borders with Africa. The 33 migrants were prosecuted for illegal entry into Moroccan soil, violence against law enforcement officers, participating in an armed gathering, and refusing to obey orders, according to a court statement. The United Nations, the African Union, and independent rights groups have condemned the use of excessive force by Moroccan and Spanish security personnel. The president of Libya's Presidential Council, Mohamed Al-Manfi, met in Zambia's capital with the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, to discuss the latest developments in Libya's tangled political process. The agenda included the role of the Presidential Council in preserving the unification of state institutions and the need to reach a political solution to the country's lingering crisis. Michel reaffirmed the EU's readiness to provide support and cooperation for the success of the Presidential Council's role in national reconciliation. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the political situation in Libya with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The European Union has not many choices what to do about the chaos in Libya. It will certainly not directly interfere in the power struggle and support one side, and it needs to cooperate with the government in Tripoli, may it be happy with it or not, with regard to migration and energy security. This means that the means to pressure or influence the government in Tripoli are in practical terms quite limited. talking about support for the national reconciliation is never ever wrong. But it would make more sense for the European Union to focus on the stabilization of Libya's south by investing there and helping to improve the living circumstances of the people in Fezzan, and to work on disarmament, demobilization and reintegration of the numerous militias.
Some analysts believe that Libya's Prime Minister Abdelhamid Beiba has made an unexpected alliance with his former enemy, the LNA commander Khalifa Haftar, in a bid to cement a fragile ceasefire and end the oil blockade. They cited a meeting between the new chief of the oil company, Ben Gaddara, and Saddam Haftar, a son of Haftar, and another LNA officials to discuss the future of the National Oil Corporation. Western governments reportedly will be happy with the return of Libyan oil to constricted world market, but some will resent the enhanced role for Haftar. What's your take on that?
Well, I would not call this an alliance between the Beiba and Haftar. There is certainly an agreement by Haftar for the appointment of Bin Gaddara, who is from Benghazi and has worked in the Arab Emirates, and he was also in touch with the Haftar family before. Haftar and most people in the East were always on odds with the NOC chairman Mustafa Sanalla. Replacing him was always part of the Eastern agenda. The paper-related oil deals with the Emirates, which were opposed by Sanalla, include the Waha oil by Sida and a refinery in the East, which should be also able to produce jet fuel, a key asset for the LNA. Those deals are not only part of the Beiba clan's strategy to enter the oil businesses, but they are certainly also in the interest of the LNA and the people in the East. However, there are especially in Misrata some critical voices about the, let's say, coordination between the Beiba and Haftar. It needs to be seen if the change of the National Oil Corporation chair will be really a starting point for a more just and transparent distribution of the oil revenues. I have some doubts.
In a highly symbolic gesture, Chief of General Staff, Lieutenant General Mohammed Al-Haddad, received LNA's Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Abdelrazzaq Al-Naturi, and members of the Military Committee 5+5 in Tripoli for the first time for talks. Could that lead to some sort of reconciliation between the rival Libyans in the east and west of the country?
The highly symbolic talks, which continue today, are held together with the East-West 5+5 Joint Military Commission. They focus primarily on confidence building, securing the ceasefire and the withdrawal of foreign forces and mercenaries, and additionally possible, unrealistically, steps to unify Libyan army and Libyan national army. A return visit by al-Haddad to Benghazi shall take place as soon as possible. Nevertheless, I would not overstate the importance of this meeting. Naturi is completely loyal to Haftar. Al-Haddad has little practical influence at all. Therefore, such meetings can hardly be expected to produce any practically relevant results. Nevertheless, they do contribute to some improvement in the climate for talks between the militaries. I need also to mention that GNU Prime Minister Dabeiba was heavily criticized, especially in Misrata, for not preventing Naturi's visit.
That was Wolfgang Pashtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The UN Refugee Agency says a repatriation program for Congolese refugees wishing to return home from Angola has resumed after a two-year break due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The UNHCR says a first convoy of 88 Congolese refugees left northern Angola and is expected to arrive in the Democratic Republic of Congo today. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
This is the first group of Congolese refugees to head home since the UNHCR's voluntary repatriation program was put on hold in 2020 by the pandemic. The agency says they will stay in a transit center for the night before crossing the border into the DRC. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshikov says more than 600 other Congolese refugees so far have indicated they too want to go home. He says other convoys are scheduled to travel through the Chisanda border crossing in the coming weeks. From there, he says, the refugees will head to various destinations in the western DRC, including Kasai, Kasai Central, and Kinshasa, the capital.
Although conflict continues in eastern DRC, improvements in security in the West have reopened the possibility for Congolese to return to their country in dignity and safety. Returning refugees have told UNHCR they are excited to restart their lives in their country after years in exile. Many have not seen family since fleeing political and ethnic violence in DRC's Kasai region in 2017.
At that time, conflict and violence sent some 35,000 Congolese refugees fleeing for their lives to Luanda Norte province in Angola. Since then, thousands of refugees have spontaneously returned to their places of origin in response to reports of improved security. Conditions in eastern DRC, on the other hand, remain extremely volatile. The United Nations says most of the 5.6 million people displaced by conflict and violence inside the country reside in the eastern provinces of North and South Kivu, Ituri, and Tanganyika. Cheshitkov says in recent weeks there's been a dramatic rise in the number of people killed and displaced due to attacks by armed groups in those areas.
At the same time, in other parts of the country, we see that the security situation has improved. And what's important is that UNHCR will always continue to advocate for the full support and essential services to be provided by the government, by the authorities, to those that are going back, especially when it comes to security, so they're able to rebuild their lives.
Cheshikov says the returnees receive a reintegration package upon their arrival in the DRC. That, he says, includes cash assistance to help pay their rent and cover basic needs such as personal hygiene and household items. He says additional support is given in enrolling children in school and helping people gather crucial civil documentation essential for the reintegration process to begin. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. International financial institutions are warning that some of Africa's biggest economies are close to economic collapse. Rising borrowing costs and inflation, stoked by negative fallout from the war in Ukraine and the after effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, have plunged countries including Egypt and Nigeria into big trouble. Zambia, meanwhile, is already in debt default. Darren Taylor reports.
Tunisia is one of several African countries desperately trying to cut a deal with the International Monetary Fund to avoid defaulting on sovereign debt repayments. Economists estimate Egypt has to pay $100 billion to creditors over the next 5 years. Ghana's currency has plummeted to record lows as its debt has soared. Kenya, currently with no access to capital markets, and with about 30% of revenues spent on interest repayments, is another traditionally strong economy in crisis. In 2020, Zambia became the first country to default during the COVID-19 era.
Zambia's debt stock at October 2021, when the new government moved into office, was about $14.4 billion. We're now somewhere around $17.1 billion of debt.
Zambian economist Yusuf Dodia says the debt burden's destroying his nation's economy. He points out that the 2021 budget allocated 46 billion kwacha, almost $3 billion, to servicing debt. This year, it's almost double that.
In other words, 45% of the national budget is going towards debt servicing, which of course starves other areas of economic endeavor from being funded by government resources.
Zambia's finance ministry is cancelling development projects valued at more than $2 billion. Dodia says Zambia accumulated its debt mostly in the past decade.
We built 3 international airports in Zambia. We have a couple of football stadiums, and that's debatable whether football stadiums constitute good debt or bad debt. We also built bridges across the Zambezi River into Botswana to make a very easy transition for trucks bringing goods and taking goods out of Zambia via Botswana. We also invested in the Kafue Gorge Lower Power Station, which is a hydroelectric power station, to supplement the electricity generation in Zambia.
Many of these projects were funded by China, to which Zambia now owes almost $6 billion, making Beijing its largest creditor. But Dodia says he doesn't see a way out of the debt hole for Zambia anytime soon.
Unfortunately, we have to borrow more money because there's a whole lot of economic infrastructure that needs to be developed in order for this country to truly grow and be able to generate revenue, not only to service debt, but also to finance the growth of the economy.
The IMF is trying to help Zambia restructure its debt to do that. Dodia says Lusaka's also negotiating with Beijing on repayments. He believes, however, that it could be time for Zambia to get into more good debt with China.
A country like Zambia that is landlocked, to make Zambia land-linked, we need a robust and wide railway network. And I think that China can provide the resources to develop a national railway network that would make the country operate more efficiently, more cost-effectively, and in fact, reduce of the huge amount of money that we put into road maintenance as a result of trucks carrying copper out of Zambia, not only for Zambia, but also...
Dodia says it doesn't make sense for a country that's the third biggest global copper producer to be in deep economic crisis. He's confident that with some smart work going forward, Zambia will emerge from its financial trouble. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
In Zimbabwe, the local currency keeps losing its value, forcing the market to demand the more stable U.S. dollar for most goods to guard against the depreciation. The government warns that this is illegal and it's difficult for consumers. Most of them are paid in the local currency. From Harare, reporter Gusai Zanwashi looks at how consumers have had to adjust to rising inflation.
The beeping sound is that of goods being scanned by a till operator in a supermarket. The cost of living has dramatically changed over the year, forcing many to change their buying patterns. Ernest Musekiwa is a breadwinner who caters for a family of four.
Every day the prices are shooting up. Even your salary is not even enough to buy the most basic things that you want for your family. You know, if you look at the bread basket right now, it's beyond the reach of many.
Like other consumers, he has had to adapt to the changing environment.
It's becoming increasingly difficult for me to buy things that I really want, that I need for my family. If you check maybe a year ago, I would afford a lot of things, I'd afford basics. But now, basic things like bread, I can't even afford to buy bread on a regular basis. It has become a luxury. I've had to make do with buying flour.
Economist Vince Museo explains how inflation is affecting retailers. He gives an example of Zimbabwe's biggest supermarket called OK.
Imagine if you're OK and you have to effectively change your prices every other day. It's laborious, isn't it? Imagine. It's just impossible. You have to look at all products every day. You are changing the price because the rate is increasing every day. The business just becomes unmanageable.
The government is trying to stabilize the economy, but this is happening against growing calls for salary increases by workers in both public and private sectors. Critics warn that if nothing is done, the situation may lead to an outbreak of strikes. Musewe advises that at a minimum, the government should accommodate workers by paying half of their salaries in US dollars to avoid erosion of their incomes. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zhinawashi from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Netson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.